As Unitarians, we have a long history of honoring each person's spiritual path, and also one of believing that social activism is closely tied to walking our talk. It's one of the things I most admire about the church. I've always believed that what we refer to as politics is actually inherently about our values. My spiritual beliefs may calm me. My desire for justice may fire my passion. I believe how we integrate them is key to my health and the impact I have in reaching my goals and keeping my integrity. Currently, we face what I see as unparalleled threats to our very own democracy, and I see people on every side of these divides in our country fighting for what they want. Even many of us who are dedicated to working toward peace and justice. The mindset to fight for peace may achieve some goals, but it backfires because any adversarial interaction triggers defensiveness, which intensifies power struggle and creates the kind of alienation we saw here this morning with the beautiful exercise you did. How long does it take to get defensive?
Nanoseconds.
That's what I used to think. And I found out that it's actually simultaneous. It takes no time at all. One man said, I don't even have to be there yet. I have to be thinking about what someone's going to say. How many people on earth do you think get defensive? Scientists have verified that when we feel any need to protect ourselves or loved ones or even an idea or a belief, the complex problem-solving part of the brain actually can be visually seen now to go to sleep instantly. And the amygdala, the center for fight, flight, and surrender, flares, at which point we cannot listen or hear or have any interaction or even think outside the mechanism of war. Dr. Joseph Ledoux said, essentially, that all it takes for us to get defensive is for anyone to do anything that anyone ever did that ever made us defensive. I think we're all standing at the edge of an abyss, waiting to fall into our defensiveness. One of my favorite quotes is from Audre Lorde, and many of you may be familiar with it. "For the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. They may allow us to temporarily beat him at his own game, but they will never enable us to bring genuine change." Historically, the master is often seen and perceived as the slave owner, or a dictator in a tyrant-slave model of power, or in current times, people with political power or corporate power. However, I believe that we do ourselves an injustice when we externalize the master by focusing on specific people that are recognized locally or globally as having a lot of power. In fact, the phrase "power corrupts" is perhaps one of the most oft-quoted phrases in modern history. It reflects the idea that the more power any person has, the more likely he or she will misuse it. But what if, in that short phrase, is an assumption and an idea that is actually responsible for most of the pain and conflict and violence in our world? I believe that's true, and I believe that the assumption is that there's only one kind of power, and that kind of power is unilateral power. We see it as external from ourselves, like a piece of a bar of gold that we have to fight over. And when that happens, basically, one person and another, or two groups, will always be in conflict fighting over who is going to get it and who is going to lose it, unless it just happens that they are on the same side. Seen through this lens, I believe any time of any day, any of us can slip into trying to become the master. It happens in simple ways. It leads us to respond by trying to get or even coerce the other person to think, feel, or do what we want. This could be as simple as, "Why don't you listen to me?" Or, "Honey, why don't you get your homework done before dinner? Then you'll be able to have free time after dinner." Unfortunately, we delude ourselves into justifying that our actions by thinking we're doing it because we care or because it's best for that person. But if they don't take our advice, how often do we get irritated, even angry, and conveying a punitive attitude, or worse? Degrees of alienation can instantly be created, even with those we love most. I think you were transmitting what I wanted to say today when you did, when bringing up the wall. I mean, that's, no matter how much we love someone, even the people we love most, when we dismiss each other, when we can't hear each other, every time it just raises the level of alienation. In larger communities, it can foster the kind of huge hostile fights we're seeing in our country right now, with people on every side communicating in ways that go to the lowest common denominator. Expressing joy at seeing someone trashed, or it just keeps going lower and lower, and the support for bullying and violence. I believe that defensiveness is the greatest glass ceiling on our human potential. And I believe also that power struggle is the most pervasive and least recognized addiction on earth. How do we fix it? Scientists studying the physiology of the brain suggest that while we can't talk someone out of being defensive, if we can communicate in any way that allows that other person to feel safe enough to move outside the defensive posture, then the defenses can drop as instantly as they came up. The thing that's important about this is that I used to think that it required the person to think about dropping their defenses. But when we're triggered to be defensive, it happens autonomically, right? It's instant. And what they're discovering is that if you can talk in a way that allows that person to feel safe, then that triggering can be released and the amygdala no longer flares and complex problem solving comes back actually instantly. Unilateral power leads us to use the rules of war not just as a metaphor, but as the entire infrastructure for our verbal interactions. A common definition of the word question is interrogation. I've never found the word curiosity used in any dictionary to define the word question. An old definition is torture during a trial, the Inquisition. Giving feedback to others is frequently focused on criticism or judgment. Expressing our own opinions often focuses on convincing others to agree with us. Predicting consequences, as in limit setting, is used to get people to do what we want or to punish them if they don't do it. Gorgias, a Greek sophist, said, "The power of speech has the same effect on the condition of the soul as the application of drugs to the state of the body. Some ways of speaking bewitch the soul with a kind of evil persuasion, others instill courage." When we learn to speak without trying in any way to control the immediate response of the other person, we can access a source of constructive power, one that can seem magical in the ease with which it can get to the heart of an issue, and create greater compassion without having to lose the integrity of our own voice or our beliefs. The irony is, we can have more power rather than less, and constructive power rather than a destructive one. I asked myself, what would a question look like if it made people feel safe and they wanted to open up? What would it be like if we could give feedback and instead of feeling criticized, someone felt respected and wanted to listen? What would it be like if we could say our own thoughts, feelings, and beliefs, and instead of trying to convince other people and alienating them, that we actually created greater understanding across lines of difference? And what would it be like if we could create boundaries and do it in a way that instead of feeling controlled and punished, people became more competent and more reciprocal? Then I changed four simple elements to accomplish this goal: intention, voice tone, body language, and some parts of phrasing. And the results were that people were dropping their defenses instantly with no residue of adrenaline, like the little girl in the story that I told a little bit earlier. While that may seem it may seem impossible, but it's not. And here's one example I think people can usually identify with. Have you ever been in a situation where you were feeling really defensive or in a very bad mood, and somebody said something hysterically funny, and you burst out laughing? And in that moment, was there any residue of the adrenaline left? And it just disappears. We have the potential to do that in our everyday lives to a degree that I think we can not even imagine. With regard to asking questions, I realize that we'd learn to ask questions in a way that overemphasizes some words, comes up in tone at the end. People often unconsciously frown and shake their heads. For example, are you upset about something? Do I look friendly? We consider it normal, but it can create a sense of being interrogated. It doesn't sound very different from, where were you at the time of the murder? I believe that curiosity is the inherent nature of the question, and to work well, I must have no agenda other than curiosity. My facial expression and my body language and my tone are all relaxed and smoothed, with no single words or phrases emphasized. If I were even to raise my eyebrow, what did you say that for? Why did you say that? It changes the entire meaning, that simple little facial expression. So I don't want to be flat or distant. I want to be present, but I don't want to be doing a lot of stuff with my face and my body language. I'm going to ask that question now in another way, and I'm going to say this time, are you feeling upset about something? What happens inside? Many people say that you feel calmer. It's like a feeling of peace. And that's exactly what I now know that I didn't know for years, based on the science of this, is that very tone and that relaxed quality allows people to step instantly out of being defensive. A mother heard me speak and went home to help her 10-year-old daughter, Maria, who'd been bullied every day on the bus by a boy on the bus. And she helped her think of a question she could ask. And Maria said, okay, I'll try, and helped her with her tone of voice, but I don't know if it'll work. And the next day she came home after school and said, Mom, it was really weird. He looked at me kind of funny, and he backed up and squinted. I mean, first she said, I just did like we talked, and I said, do you think I want you to talk to me that way? And he looked at me really funny, and he backed up, and he said, well, no, I guess not. And I met the mom at a conference a whole year later, and she told me he'd never bullied her again. I was talking with an African-American woman I met at a conference, and we were having a wonderful conversation about our grandkids. And as we were talking, I assumed that her granddaughter was about the same age as my 8-year-old twin grandsons. And then later I learned I asked her how old her granddaughter was, and she said, well, she's 15. And I was surprised. So I said, oh, wow, you don't look old enough to have a 15-year-old daughter. And suddenly she kind of froze up, and it felt like the whole energy changed. And she looked at me and said, well, that's ageist. And I always tell people, you'll see me do everything I teach not to do, so it's very easy to get defensive. I came from an argumentative family, and my mother said that I was behind the door when God passed out the censer between the brain and the mouth. So I sort of stopped for a minute, and then I thought to myself, I don't know why this thought came to me, but I suddenly thought, I wonder if it was racist too, but it was easier to say it was ageist. And so I said to her, was it racist? And she said, yes. She said, I can't tell you how many times when people find out I have a 15-year-old daughter that they assume that I gave birth to my daughter when I was 15 living in some ghetto somewhere. So what's important here was not my intention. One of the things that I've done work with people on unlearning racism for white people, and one of the things that we talk about is that we have a tendency to want to say, oh, that's not what I meant, and we may be saying it as reassurance, but as soon as you do that, you're defending yourself rather than focusing on the experience of what happened to that other person. And so it's very important to think about impact rather than intent, and I was very glad that I'd asked the question because it totally restored our connection to each other. Years ago, I trained activists who were working to defeat a measure that would have prevented gay or lesbian people in the state of Oregon from ever teaching at any level, from kindergarten through university level. And So I trained the people, and then they, many of them were, you know, campaigning at the fair, and a man came up and started saying, you know, it's a sin, and we're going to be, our children are going to be in danger, and we have to pass this measure. And the people behind the counter saw him accelerating and getting more and more angry and volatile, and they were afraid they were going to have to call security. And then one of them, who had been in the training that I had done, kind of stopped for a minute and thought of a question, and she looked at him and she said, do you believe we're ever going to agree on this? And she said that it was as if he was puffed up like a balloon and someone just took a little pin and went, psst, and he just went, shoo, and he went, no, I guess not. And he turned around and he walked off. So I always tell stories because the impact of this process, I think, is hard to believe until we can really see that we have such a power to diffuse defensiveness that we have not accessed. So now with regard to statements, one of the two parts of the statement is giving feedback to other people. And I believe that the inherent nature of feedback is to hold up the mirror. It's not to try to convince or change someone. It's to let that person know, here's what I'm seeing in your emotion or your beliefs or your feelings. I had a counseling session with a couple that were not really on the verge of divorce, but perhaps getting there. And they hadn't been in the room for very long when she said to him, you're just so angry all the time. And he said, I am not angry. Now, I'm in kind of a bind, right? Because if I don't address an issue that blatant, then the wife is going to feel like, oh, she's going to soft pedal with my spouse. And if I do address it, he might think, she's a woman, my wife is a woman, they're going to gang up on me, right? So what I did was I used one part. This afternoon we'll talk about three steps for giving feedback. I used just one of them. And I looked at him and I said, when I look at you, what I'm seeing is lines etched in your face that seem to be almost etched into a mask of anger. And he stared at me. And then he said, do you have a mirror? And I said, yes, down the hallway. And he said, okay. And he went down the hallway and he came back a minute later and he went, my God, you're right. Now, they had been married 18 years. How long do you think they've had this argument? And how many times in 18 years? We can't estimate that, right? But what's very interesting was he came back with pure... The shift he made was out of being defensive into curiosity when he asked for the mirror. And when he came back, his tone was that of insight. Like, wow, I just got a great insight. So he actually had no defensiveness left, was literally able to make that kind of statement of accountability in front of his wife. Without an ounce of energy directed at needing to somehow protect himself or defend himself. I think that the inherent nature of the other part of the statement, which is about stating our own thoughts, feelings, and beliefs, is simply put, story. It's our story. It's not an effort to change you, to make you be different, to get you to listen to me. It is just our ability to tell our own story. And I think for each of us, our story, our voice, is one of the essential rights in our democracy. It means not only being able to say what we believe and feel, but allowing someone else to do it. And I certainly draw the line at the kind of expression that is actively inciting violence. But up until that point, if we can't listen to other people talk about things that they believe, even when they are a violation of our own beliefs, I think sometimes we think that we're going to be giving up our position if we even listen. And I don't think that that's true. I want to be free to say, beyond all realms we would identify as political or partisan, I am more than heartbroken when I see children ripped from their parents' arms, when I see their toys taken away, when I see them crying in cold cells. And I drive down the street now and I watch parents pushing their children in buggies or walking with them, and they're black and they're brown and they're white. And I wonder, how can someone want to punish those children? What would those parents do if it happened to them? And how different is that story from saying, the people doing this are evil, it's terrible, it's awful, what are we going to do with them? They should all just be shot, they're soulless. How different is it to tell our story than to move into the judgment and the blame and the anger? It's easy to do. I can certainly rant at the news on TV all by myself. I don't even need anyone else in the room with me. I've heard from many people that when they're trying to have a conversation, and I understand this, with someone whose values are diametrically opposed, even when we see such huge threats, it's very, very hard not to get triggered and to get defensive and to get angry or blaming or to shut down and avoid the argument. But a disparaging attitude doesn't require spoken words to have an impact, to build that wall. As long as we're in an adversarial mindset, we'll remain caught in power struggle. It not only depletes us, but it deprives us of the positive energy of our own voice. Judgment is the great divider. In the process, we can also easily lose our ability to see the other person as worthy of being treated with any semblance of respect. I want to know about the man or woman that lives in that border state, that perhaps hates the immigrants. Why do they hate them? How did they come to hate them? Did they learn from their parents? Or are they in such poverty that when they see thousands of people coming across the border, they're in abject fear that the little they have will become even less and they'll have nothing? I still struggle, and I know that only as I become increasingly conscious of my own accountability in creating and contributing to any conflict, person by person, conversation by conversation, will I have the power to speak in ways that can reach hearts without losing the integrity of my own values. Anytime we succumb to our own sense of superiority and try to convince, control, or demean others, we lose opportunity and we lose hope, whether at home or in community. As we free ourselves from what I think of as the power struggle prison, we won't need to be dependent on other people's cooperation to secure our own power. We can be free to use it with far greater effectiveness and compassion. I think of it as having the heart and the spine together. Doing so can bring our spirituality and our passion for justice together, strengthening both as individuals and as a community. Is it within the realm of our human potential to eradicate defensiveness and power struggle? The magnitude of it can often seem impossible to me, and yet I still believe that the answer is yes. In his book, The Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell uses many vivid examples to demonstrate that most real change on earth happens at a grassroots level. And this is crucial because I think we've had beliefs and myths passed down that negate this idea, but positive change is as contagious as a disease. It can spread rapidly from one person to another. That encourages me. The potential is infinite. One conversation at a time, every time. Music critic Chris Richards said of Aretha Franklin, "She surfaced her humanity through her singing." I want to imagine what could happen if millions of us were to increasingly surface our own humanity through our attitudes and our words.